Hello and welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man that drives around looking for Lou's Taverns. It's Phil Briggs.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
We're starting. I've been waiting out on the porch with my podcast gear for the last 3 days, and Mark, you've been berating me and hitting me with your broom and telling me to go away. I can't believe we're actually starting.
And did you bring it all? Did you bring your Yeti mic? Did you bring your computer, your charger?
I got all my gear. I got my black boots and my black t-shirt, so I'm ready to rock and roll here.
Oh, that's amazing. It dawned on me when we started to record that I have an IKEA desk, and it holds all of my Blu-rays and DVDs because I still buy practical media. And I'm just looking at my IKEA desk right now. And then I'm just looking, you know, I had some Starbucks earlier. Man, I'm a total space monkey. But I kind of love how... Total sellout, Phil.
You're a sellout.
Even though the people in Project Mayhem form franchises across the country and then they all dress the exact same and look alike, just like people working in a corporate boring job, they all become one identity as well. I love Fight Club, man. I love this movie. You know, can I tell you something, Phil? So when I watched this when I was 17, I wasn't part of that Generation X. So I was 17. I wasn't like one of those dudes in the 90s who, you know, 26, 27, wore flannel. Matt Dillon. I wasn't Matt Dillon in the 90s. So I never, you know, when watching this movie, I know a lot of people have a feeling about this film like I'm owed things. You know, I grew up, I should have this. This is what we're told we'll have. I don't think I ever had that when I was 17. I never expected anything. I just was like, you just work for it. Like, you buy a DVD, work for it. Like Fight Club, I skipped school to go buy it with money I bought from Burger. Like, I made at Burger King. So like, I never had that mentality of these guys. But I did buy a shirt that said "Kick someone's ass," and it was a Fight Club shirt. I think I bought it from Spencer's, and I wore it to school, and I got kicked out of school for wearing it. So then I had to go change my shirt. So this movie, watching it when I was 17 and then watching it now, I'm not saying I feel like I'm owed anything, but now watching it now, I find so much more humor in it. I find so much more comedy in it. I find it more as intended. But in 17, I don't think I ever idealized Durden. I was more of a Norton guy, or Brad Pitt. I was a huge Norton fan, but it's so neat watching this movie from when you're 17 to when you're 27 to when I'm 39 right now. And just the evolution of this movie as I've evolved. It's just, man, and then, like, I've never explored the DVD. It's funny, this movie's all about, like, anti-corporate stuff, but I bought that DVD that came out 20-some years ago with, like...
Phenomenal DVD. Yeah,
amazing.
And yeah, just I have it as well.
Beautiful. It's, like, 22 years old, and I finally listened to the commentaries, and this is the first time I've ever really explored Fight Club. And I just want to say thank you for suggesting this, because I've never really looked below the surface of this film. I've always just appreciated it as a stylistic romp with solid performances and that. But now I've really, you know, I read the book on a tarmac in Scotland when a plane was delayed. That's a very pretentious story. But I've never, like been that Fight Club guy. But I've always liked Fight Club. But it's just been really interesting to have all these old emotions come forth. Watching this movie and think about where I was then to when I walked inside of a Target to buy it to where I am now. It's been a lot of fun just going back through all this.
I'm so glad to hear that. And, you know, I know we're just diving right in here, which I love. You know, I would say when we chat about what movies, you know, what movies would make for a good episode, to me, Fight Club has always been near the top of the list. It did really make me rethink my whole life when you texted me and said, we've got like a loose theme going of like, you know, between Limitless and Never Back Down and The Prestige, of like all of these like damaged and broken, you know, guys finding meaning through fighting or violence or using drugs or, you know, whatever. So it really, I was like, man, is there a common theme here that is resonating with me for some reason. I don't know what that says about me, but I really relate to what you just said, because very similar for me. I was a young guy when I first saw this movie, and to see this movie in sort of your late teen, early 20s, very formative years compared to late 20s to now mid 30s, completely different experience every single time. And regardless of like how we connect with this movie personally, I would say that this is definitely a movie that is just amazing to talk about. Just in terms of the culture, I know that as we were both sort of preparing, we were sharing back and forth like all kinds. There's just a mountain of articles and commentary and discussion about what this film means and the impact that it's had on culture, the impact that it's had on men, you know, growing up, like it's sort of like you're saying in that Generation X generation. It's just been an impactful movie that I can't wait to dive into.
Yeah, and you know, looking at IMDb, it has an 8.8 score, and it's the number 12 out of it's the 12th highest rated movie on IMDb with over 2 million ratings. I mean, this DVD, wow, when it came out, it sold over 6 million DVDs. And if you remember back in 99, so this DVD came out in 2000, but DVDs were still in their infancy, and DVDs were still very expensive. I remember I bought Deep Blue Sea and Analyze This. Those were the so I bought my DVD player, saving up all my money. It was $238. I'm like, well, I have to watch something on these. So I went to go buy two movies, and it was Deep Blue Sea and Analyze This. And I think that set me back $50. That's
holy shit.
Yeah. And so buying Fight Club, this wasn't cheap. This wasn't nowadays where, you know, you wait a few months and you can buy a movie for really cheap on digital. You can, you know, get it cheap later on. But I remember this DVD cost me an arm and a leg, and I didn't have an arm and a leg. I could probably give like a finger, not an arm or a leg, but I remember buying it. But just hold, I don't know, for some reason, this movie, but you know what's weird? So many people have gravitated towards the Brad Pitt character. This, you know, in the movie, he's a parasite, right? He's infiltrated Edward Norton's mind. He's seen glimpses of him. Like, Pitt's in there. He had been in there. Durden had been in there. He's just this parasite waiting to take over from the narrator. But for me, I just, when Edward Norton kicked off in Primal Fear, and then he appeared in American History X, and then he appeared in Rounders, in Fight Club. I just in Death to Smoochie. I remember in 2000, gosh, when was it? Maybe 2001, 2002, when Death to Smoochie and Panic Room came out the same weekend, which is a Fincher movie and a Norton movie. I had like a mini panic attack because I could watch movies on Thursdays, and I was like, which one do I pick? And I was watching the next one on Friday, but it was that important to me. Like, what do I do? Do I watch Fincher or Norton? I don't know. So watching this movie again reminds me of how much I love the Edward Norton role in this. And reading about this now, and there's so many commentaries and so many people talking about it where Fincher was saying that Norton wanted it to be very wacky. He wanted it to be outwardly wacky, kind of like a Dr. Strangelove, which is my second favorite film of all time. I think it's one of the greatest movies I've ever watched in my life. And I also watched that my junior year of high school. That's when I watched Fight Club. And Fincher brings it up so many times in his commentary, Dr. Strangelove. So Norton wanted to be like outward. He wanted people to get the joke. But then Fincher didn't want people to get the joke, but he kind of wanted people to get the joke. But I'm kind of glad they met in the middle. But I do, you know, but the main complaint, I'm all over the place with this movie. When you do as much research as I do, and then like you start talking about it, I feel like I'm just like a fire hose that, I don't know, got turned up to 11 and is just got turned on and no one's holding it. And it's just flying all over the place. I guess what I find interesting about this movie is watching it now at 39, I get a lot of more of the humor. I get more of I understand it more. But it's really not like, it's not a Don't Look Up. It's not In Your Face.
Right.
Like, you could read this movie wrong. You could really read this movie, and many people have. So I think it's interesting what Fincher decided to do, where he doesn't have to hold the audience's hand, but he gives you enough, but also he doesn't give you a lot. So it's really easy to read on both levels, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. It's not so explicitly a parody, and there's enough sort of like deep truths to a certain degree, I guess, in this movie is maybe how I would phrase that. And I guess what I mean by that is, or the way that I tried to think about it, because I watching it now as a 35-year-old, I was thinking back and going, what was it about this movie at 19 or 20? That really appealed to me at the time. And I can remember at a philosophical level thinking that this movie was very eye-opening and very influential. And it felt like there were answers in this movie that now, as a 35-year-old man, I'm like, this is not, these are not the answers. The answers are, it's not to just destroy, you know, start destroying society and, you know, form a club with your buddies and start punching each other in the face. That's not the answer. But I do think that it does hit on a theme that a lot of great films, I mean, I think about even American Beauty as well, which came out this same year as well, that has some similar themes. The idea of sort of the American dream and the consumerism that this movie rallies against, the idea that your identity is not found in your job, it's not found in the material possessions that you purchase. I think that there's a lot of deep truth there. And so to a certain degree, I think that there are a lot of great premises here in this movie. And then maybe the conclusions, like where the conclusions that the characters inevitably, I guess, go after are maybe where the parody starts to come in a little bit. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah,
so it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
It's highlighting some problems that are real problems that I think people really do struggle with, that I think a lot of young men struggle with, about finding their purpose and finding meaning. And this movie certainly takes like a nihilistic sort of turn towards, okay, well, maybe meaning is, you know, found in destroying, you know, tearing down corporations and things along those lines. I'm, again, not sure that those are the conclusions that we want to be drawing, and I'm not sure that the movie is seriously suggesting that. I think that that's where the parody comes in. But I think that there's enough where it sort of highlights these real life issues that a lot of people struggle with, a lot of questions that a lot of people are asking themselves. So I see what you're saying. It's sort of that middle ground where people still revere this movie and take this movie very seriously, I think, and maybe in some cases more seriously than it takes itself, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And we can't blame Fincher for that, because, I mean, this movie is beloved. But you know what's interesting too is I think it's the time when it hit that has connected with so many people, because, you know, 99 Woodstock, remember, mm-hmm. Limp Bizkit and tearing everything down. Columbine was an issue. There's a lot of anger. Also too, mm-hmm. if you look back at a lot of Generation X type movies, I mean, you had the baby boomers coming back in the 40s, settling down, factory jobs, 9-to-5s, doing that. These were a lot of the kids of those people who lived in that generation, who worked the factories, who hid everything, you know, who swallowed everything and didn't express their feelings and had too many martinis. And I'm not saying everything. I'm talking about Mad Men right now, which isn't right.
Yeah.
I just think this generation, though. But when you look at the Generation X of the 90s, and those are a lot of the movies I grew up, you know, the Ethan Hawkes, the Matt Dillons, the Ben Stillers, and that kind of world where these people are just kind of like, what do I want? Where am I? What am I? I don't want to do this. This isn't my world. And so I think when this hit, you had kind of the anger of the time. I think there's a lot of entitlement in this movie too, some of that hitting. And then I think there's also just, I don't know, I think it hit at the exact right, and then it didn't do well. I think a lot of people ignored that it's a $65 million movie that shot over 100 and what did I see here? 129 nights. And I learned a lot about Fincher's process in this in 99. He shot 139 mm-hmm. days, 10-hour days. They did French hours because they did a lot of company moves or so many shots. So he just, once they got somewhere, they just shot all day, which I thought was really interesting. That's the way he shoots. We can go off on that later. But I just think it hit at the right time. I think it, but I also, you got to remember, it's a $65 million Fox movie. And I think the mm-hmm. book, right? The book's much more inflammatory. It's still kind of a piece of satire, punk rock writing. But a $65 million movie should not inspire fight clubs and burning down Starbucks too, right? So, but that's how good this movie. I think this movie got so many people pumped up on it that they sort of didn't think about, like, hey, I just watched a $65 million movie. Or you watched Dark Knight and you love the Joker, but it's a $200 million superhero movie with a Batman. So I don't know. I think it's one of those movies that came out at the perfect time. It didn't do well, so it developed a cult status. Critics hated it for its violence. Rosie O'Donnell blasted it. She gave away the ending.
Rosie O'Donnell, right?
Like, everybody really was not into this movie. And I remember loving it. I didn't have the reaction. I didn't want to go to Woodstock and stomp somebody or join a fight club. But I just thought I watched something really cool and stylish. And you know what's interesting too is Fight Club is not that violent, but there are some very startling images. So, you know, you have the scene of like the condoms in the toilet that Fox wanted Fincher to get rid of. You have the line where she's like, you know, I haven't had that since grade school. Her original line is so much worse than what that was.
So much worse.
Yeah. And so, but then you watch it and you have the bloody scene with Angel Face. You have Brad Pitt getting beat up in the club by the guys who owned it. And yes, there is some violence in the movie. But
the acid scene on the hand.
Acid on the hand.
That actually I read somewhere was the scene when Brad Pitt's parents were going to watch the movie. He said to them, don't watch the movie. You're not going to enjoy it. And they still wanted to watch it and didn't really listen to him. So he showed them that scene and that scene only. And that convinced them that maybe they would pass on it.
Oh, man. And I mean, it's not a bad idea. But I guess the violence in this movie is Brad Pitt Tyler Durden relishing getting beaten. Angel Face getting pummeled based on the jealousy of the narrator. I think the violence in this, it hits, for lack of a better term, it hits really hard, and thus it's more memorable than opposed to a, you know, the big hit where Mark Wahlberg and his crew are killing 7,000 people. But it's just kind of so stylish that the violence, you know, you're so accustomed to it. But then I think this one, you know, what's interesting too about the fights in this, I feel like the fights feel real. The narrator loses. Durden loses a couple fights. The blood that happens. And listen too, like, I think one thing that if someone's never been in a fight, the interesting thing about being in a fight or a boxing match or when you're rolling, the freeing thing to that is that's what's on your mind. And I think that's why I love boxing, because when you're boxing, you only have to think about that. You can't think about rent. Right. You can't think about like, what am I eating for dinner later? I think it focuses you, and it really it puts you like in a different place. It really, like, for a while, you're not thinking. You're just sort of reacting. And
I think it's super cool. I totally agree. And the thing about the fight scenes in this movie, unlike, you know, you watch like Jason Bourne, or you watch, you know, we watch Never Back Down, and you've got all these trained killers that know exactly what they're doing. The movements are precise and efficient. There's no precision. There's no efficiency. It's just it's raw. It's just untrained to a certain degree. And so I agree. I totally agree with you. Where you can sort of see like, I think, you know, it's a great contrast to, say, the Bourne films, where every single thing in the room becomes a weapon, and Jason Bourne is just, you know, lightning fast, where in Fight Club, it's really got that it's so visceral and just so untrained, I guess, is the way that I sort of think of that, where it really does feel like two guys from The Office that don't really know what they're doing. And so to a certain degree, it's about the fight. And it's about, you know, being in the moment, like you're saying, but it's less about the skill or who wins the fight. It doesn't matter who wins the fight to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. It's about being in the moment, and it's about that experience more than it is about the fighting technique or, you know, all the things that we talk about all the time, like in MMA, for example, right? Like getting into a dominant position and the technique and this and that. It really is about almost the spiritual aspect of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And just having that, I guess, having that group of people around you fighting and then like being able to walk away from it. And then that's wrecked. That whole illusion is wrecked by the narrator as well. And then it becomes something. You know, I guess what started off as quote unquote pure, listen, I understand this movie was written as a satire, but like what starts off as pure, I think really becomes corrupted with the different franchises and, you know, the blocks and then the corruption. And I guess that's like anything. And it's just kind of funny that Fight Club starts off as something pure, but then it becomes a corporation. Then it becomes Project Mayhem with folders and computers, and it becomes a well-oiled machine. It's just, there's some great humor in that. And, you know, Chuck Palahniuk, this all came from him going on a camping trip, and he just came back with some bruises on him and no one asked him about it. And then he started developing this idea. I don't know. I just, yeah. But once again, I think this movie is done so well that people forget that Edward Norton, Tyler Durden is a parasite, if that makes sense. He's not Durden. You know what's interesting too is Durden rarely ever, he expresses platitudes a lot. Durden's like Mr. Platitude, I think. But his solution,
it's a yearbook quote, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But his solutions, but see, when you're 17, dude, and you don't have like, you know, for me, I didn't have like the best structure. You know, you don't have like a parental structure around. You hear this, you're like, yeah. But now you watch it, and it just feels like the platitudes. It feels like comments that he's saying, and he offers very little real world practicalities. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's. I'm telling you, man, this movie, the way it's evolved, it has been a kind of a joy for me to sort of rewatch and dive into. But yeah, and also too, I mean, this is another movie where the breaking of the fourth wall and the overall stylistic performance. I mean, Brad Pitt's alive in this movie. Edward Norton's perfect catalyst for this. And then you got Jared Leto, you have Meatloaf, you have Holt McCallany. You have, I mean, Helena Bonner Carter, who's just perfect in this. You just kind of have this
amazing,
excellent supporting cast. You have, I mean, technical sheen on top of technical sheen. Like, I listened to the commentary on this and just, you know, the costume designer, the DP, and the amount of work that went into making this, because Fincher, he loves his grays, his light, his dark blues, his whites, but they had to fight to get color in there with Tyler Durden, and just hearing about the process of that, and hearing about, you know, at the end, that end explosion took over a year, because that's where 99 special effects were at, and hearing about the music, and just the breakdown of all of this. This is a technically polished movie. It is, I mean, it's just, I mean, you know, they bought, like, the locations look gross. The light, they brought little lights that they could just plug in different spots to make it seem like real crappy practical lighting. And, you know, the first day of filming, I listened to this. He said that they shot 40,000 feet of film. Now, El Mariachi, the entire movie, was on 7,000 feet of film. Desperado, 45,000 feet of film. Jeez. So in one day, Fincher shot almost as much as the entire shoot, 35-day shoot of Desperado.
That's insane.
Yeah, but you know what I like about Fincher, and I want to hear your thoughts about this. Like, I feel like when you hear about Fincher, you just hear, oh, he does 100 takes, and oh, he does 80 takes, and oh, is it necessary? But if you're going to do a Fincher movie, you know that. So when you go into a Fincher film, just be ready for it. And what he likes to do is, he likes to do 10-hour days. You show up to his set and you shoot that scene. That's it. He doesn't do a company move. This isn't a Tom Cruise movie. We're going to four different locations in one day. You park your vehicles. You sit down. You get the extras. And you do the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. I feel like there's very little surprise with him on set. I feel like it would be a well-run set because you know what to expect. And that's what a lot of the people talked about. Like, they did a huge pre-pro area, and it seemed like the problem on this was Edward Norton was fighting with Fincher a lot. So Holt McCallany said that they just would wait a half an hour while they argued about like what total, like, should it be a 10 wacky, 1 wacky, 3 wacky. So a lot of time was wasted on that, but that's why Fincher did 139-day shoot in one location as opposed to company moves, because he knew there would be arguments, he knew there would be kind of that stuff. So I hate this narrative of like, oh, why does he do 100 takes? He's so open about it that if you're going to do a Fincher movie, just be ready for it. Is that, am I crazy?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think that the results, like when I think about two of my favorite scenes in Fincher films, it's the two conversations where two characters are talking at a bar, and it's in this movie and it's in The Social Network.
Social Network. Yeah.
And The Social Network, again, as you're saying, infamously was, you know, they did whatever, hundreds of takes with Jesse Eisenberg and Rooney Mara. And that's where you have not only Fincher, who is a stickler for, you know, let's do it 100 times and let's get all kinds of things. You've got Aaron Sorkin there as well, who also wrote that scene, who's a stickler for, you know, the dialogue and the delivery and the beats and all of that. And so I think, you know, I like the approach. I mean, the scene where Brad Pitt and Edward Norton are talking in the bar in this film, apparently they filmed, you know, hundreds of times, and Brad Pitt just ended up ad-libbing a lot of his dialogue as well, and they ended up cutting a lot of it together. And I think that the results speak for themselves to a certain degree. I mean, I'm not the biggest Fincher film in the fan in the entire world. I love this movie. I really love The Social Network. But I think, you know, his approach, I'm not sure that you could question it. The results speak for themselves.
I mean, that was a 40,000 feet of film day with Brad Pitt in the bar. They were just talking all day, and they just had two cameras rolling, and the DP and gaffer hated it because they had to light two scenes. But yeah, like, I mean, you look at Social Network now. I know it didn't win Best Picture, but it's looked at as a bona fide classic. I think it was voted best. A major site said it was the best film of the 2010s. I mean, it is a masterpiece. You look at Zodiac, where I'm not going to say it's the most enjoyable watch, but that movie,
it's such a crazy movie.
That movie is burned in my memory. I see it. And I watch so many movies. So right now, Phil, this is how I envision my brain. It's just a bucket filled with water. And so when new stuff comes in, some water comes out. Does that make sense?
But, Eureka, yes.
Yeah, with so much stuff coming in, so many research things, I still have Zodiac just in my mind up there. The opening scene with in the park when he goes into the basement, just the conversations. It is, I can't shake it. It's so yeah, Fincher, I think, yes. Why do you need 100 takes? But then you go make Gone Girl, which features a all-timer performance from Rosamund Pike. You make Mank with beautiful performances. I mean, it looks spectacular. So yeah, I just think, I don't like this narrative about him. He has to answer all these questions over and over and over. But he's so up. He's been up. So I loved hearing this because in 99, he was upfront about it. So we're talking, I mean, all the way dating all the way back to what? Alien. Well, he couldn't do that with Alien 3. So he started with 7 and then he went to The Game and then this. So he's been doing this for 27 years. So I don't know. I just think I just hate this narrative because every article I read is just 40, 50 takes, 100 takes. But I don't know. It's what you're getting into. If you shoot an Inarritu movie with The Revenant, you're gonna be in pain for 100 days. So just get ready for it. Like I don't know. I just thought that was kind of interesting. That's my tangent because I just respect how Fincher works. I like his style. I don't think he's trying to take advantage of his crew or his actors. I remember an interview he said, I have actors on set. I'm going to make them work. He's like, I'm paying them. they're getting paid for 139 days. Like, they're going to work. I love that aesthetic about him. So I don't know. And I think, too, this movie, he gets that out of it. I mean, this is such a visually impressive film with so many different cuts, so many different scenes. And it felt so hip and alive at the time. And I would put Brad Pitt's performance up there as one of the most alive performances of recent memory, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It especially because at this point in his career too, like, it kind of felt like Brad Pitt needed this kind of performance, right? I mean, he'd been nominated for 12 Monkeys, which was sort of a pretty off the wall performance as well, but that was pretty far before this, I think, right? And then he maybe had a few duds between then. Like, I feel like this was around like the Meet Joe Black, and I don't know, he'd had a couple stinkers in and around this time. And so this performance, I think, was one that it's such a grimy, when you think of like Brad Pitt, like leading man, A-list actor dating Jennifer Aniston, and this is such a contrast to that at this point in his career that, you know, and he's had some amazing performances since then. But when I don't know, I think that this is probably his best performance ever. It's just unlike anything he'd done. I'm just trying to scroll through his IMDb to see what else he had done in and around then. But
well, I think you're right because what Thelma and Louise in 91, he was kind of the beef, you know, the beefcake, you know, like the good looking dude. And then he went into Legends of the Fallen, Interview with the Vampire, where he was kind of very pouty, very tortured. He just
right.
And then you kind of get him moving on. As an actor, like Meet Joe Black, they tried something on that, but it didn't hit too hard. And then I think 7 was really good.
Yeah.
But that was, he was just kind of a detective. He was still, he was kind of dour and down. 12 Monkeys was great. He did get an Oscar nomination, but I think you're right. He's very twitchy in that. It's a very like, it showed he could maybe do Unhinged, but I think Fight Club, because they did Sleepers, Devil's Own. I love his Irish accent. Joe Black. But then Fight Club, though, was his first where it was him. There was no accent. Yeah. There were no twitches. This movie rested on his charisma, his style, him having fun. We talked about this. Bradley Cooper in Limitless. Hugh Jackman in Prestige. There's no prosthetics. There's no twitchiness, if that makes sense. There's no, it's not a biopic. They're not hiding under things. It's just them. And I think that this is the moment for me, at least, when I saw Brad Pitt. I was like, whoa, this guy he can pout. We already know he can pout. We know he can do kind of weird and twitchy. We know he can do serious, but here he's like funny and charismatic. Like he's almost like a cult leader.
He's getting his front teeth chipped, he's all in committed. Yeah. That I couldn't believe that when I read that. It's so crazy. Totally agreed. And then he goes on after this, actually, just looking Snatch. At his IMDb here, he goes Snatch after that, which is, again, such an amazing performance as well.
I skipped school to go see that because I was a huge Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels fan. So I went and watched that. Yeah, he was awesome in that. But, right, I think this movie is when he became this is like his next level moment. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? I think this is a better performance than 12 Monkeys. I mean, I love him in 12 Monkeys, but he's just kind of doing the paranoid Terry Gilliam thing. Here, I just think it's all star power. And I don't know, kind of like Bradley Cooper with Limitless. I mean, he carried that movie. He's not hiding behind anything in that movie, Bradley Cooper. He nails it. And I also think we talked about Prestige. I'm saying this again, but that's the best performance by Hugh Jackman by far. I think that's the role he was kind of born to play. I mean, he's good in Logan, but that's his best to Prestige.
I think part of it, too, is that it's like I just couldn't imagine anybody else in this role. Brad Pitt is Tyler Durden, and when you read through some of the behind the scenes around the making of this movie and some of the other casting choices that were considered, like Russell Crowe, at one point the studio I think wanted Russell Crowe to be in the movie. I mean, Russell Crowe is an amazing actor, but I couldn't imagine this being anybody other than Brad Pitt,
because he has that humor. He's just a little devil in this movie. He really is. He's very devilish. He's very – that dancing scene with Helena Bonham Carter when the cops come and he dances with her, and when he's riding the bike around.
He's swinging the nunchucks in the living room when Edward Norton's on the phone. That part cracked me up yesterday watching this. And there's so many little things like that that he does that I either didn't notice before or forgot about. But, yeah, he just brings so much charisma to the role.
He nails it. Yeah, it's
– Nails it.
Yeah, it's – just you could tell he loved it too. They said that they rented a mansion before an office before this movie started, and they'd have these Nerf gun and Mountain Dew drinking sessions where they would just stay up and go through each line of the script like it was. They said it was like gospel, or Shakespeare. They said so. Each line they analyzed over, they poured over, and I don't picture Brad Pitt drinking Mountain Dew. When I heard Mountain Dew, I'm like. And do you think – I don't picture Norton or Brad Pitt drinking Mountain Dew. That seems – I don't know. This seems – that's the one
thing. Not sophisticated enough for them. I read somewhere, too.
Months.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, just months of pre-pro. I mean, they just months of it. But you could tell these are lived in – I mean, he had to get in shape, too, Pitt. You know what's funny? They're making fun of the underwear models, and then you just have Brad Pitt just shredded out of his mind. It's such a contradiction. But I love that about him. I mean – in Norton's mind, in the narrator's mind, he created the perfect man, right? He created what the perfect version of him, if that is what it is. So then they're making fun of perfect versions of people, but then you have Tyler Durden running around. It's so
interesting too, because it really highlights again what we were mentioning earlier about some of the common themes of some of the other films that we've talked about. Like, again, to go back to Limitless, it's like, you know, you on this drug that makes you awesome, that makes you smart, that makes you interesting, confident. And then here you have Edward Norton essentially creating this fantasy version of himself that I think Brad Pitt uses those exact words at one point. He says, I'm smart. I'm capable. I'm everything that you're not. I look how you want to look. I do all the things that you sort of wish that you could do. And maybe that's, I mean, I was going to ask you earlier. So I think we've agreed that like watching this as like mid 30s guys is a really different experience than watching it as sort of impressionable, you know, young teenagers. So what is it that is appealing about this movie? Is it that? Is it the, you know, seeing this sort of unrealistic character that is free in ways that, you know, we, you know, in society aren't free, that says what he really thinks, that does whatever he wants to do? Like, why is this character so revealed and so appealing to some people?
Yeah, I think exactly what you said. I mean, there's just devil may care. He wants destruction. He wants chaos. He doesn't want us to be, the character says we're not defined by what we buy. And mm-hmm. I think you could like, you know what I think is good about this character is that you could like this character on several different levels. It's like a Verhoeven movie. I don't know, Paul Verhoeven, you could watch Starship Troopers and be like, yeah, blood and guts. Or you could watch it and be like, hey, this is hilarious because it's like a fascist take. It's funny. It's satire. Like, I think mm-hmm. Pitt, if you're in on the joke with Pitt, right, you know that he is a troublemaker, a devil, part of the narrator, then you love how subversive it is. You love how not on the nose it is. Like, there's very little winking by Brad Pitt, so you like that. Or you could just like it on the surface level of this dude is awesome. Like, this dude, you know what I mean? Like, he's just ripped, cool. He can pull off wild sunglasses. He wears the craziest clothes, but he looks neat. He can just, you know, set up this cult. He's still successful. He buys rich people's fat and sells it back to them. He's just an all around, you know, cool dude. Or you could look at him as like a cult leader. This guy, he's given me very little solutions, but he's given me a lot to think about. And yes, you know what? I don't have it all. I don't, you know, I was told I was going to get this, and I don't. So I'm going mm-hmm. to rally against society. And he also spoke towards, you know, he also speak towards the people who take care of your soup, who work in your projection booth, who fix your car, the cops. Mm-hmm. Like, he spoke towards, he really aims everything towards blue collar workers too. So I think there's three ways to look at him. You're in on the joke, or you just think he's a cool dude, or you just buy into his mantra. I think mm-hmm. that's maybe three ways to look into this character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. And so, you know, because when I think about it, I was sort of, again, trying to think about, like, what is it that about this that is appealing to me? Like, even, you know, I would say that I lean now more towards being in on the joke and sort of seeing this more for what it is nowadays. But I do agree with you. I think that there's something to be said for the idea of trying to, you know, take control of your life as well, right? And not just sort of like mindlessly follow the path that society lays out before you. And it is worth the time and effort to think about your purpose and your values and to try to, you know, carve out a life that is yours and is in alignment with whatever you think living a good life is. Again, I think it's like a great starting point, and I think that the movie lays that out as a great starting point of like, here's a bunch of things, and this is still applicable today, right? You can go on social media and see everybody posting, you know, pictures of their best selves and really feel as though, you know, things like going on vacation and looking awesome in an Instagram, you know, picture, that's what life is all about. And I think there's something to be said for saying, you know what, like, sometimes we have bad days and I don't know. I'm just, there's something to be said for thinking, I guess, for yourself and trying to take responsibility for your life. But again, where this movie kind of goes off the rails a little bit is to then say, okay, well, let's, you know, do that in a destructive way. Like, I think it's great to try to like build something and work hard and like have good relationships and like spread love and positivity throughout the world. And that's not really presented necessarily as an option here, or it's done in like, it's done in such a strange way, right? Where we're like, we're taking Raymond, the convenience store worker, and we're, you know, making him think that his life is about to be over. And then, you know, I can remember thinking that was so powerful around the idea of like, tomorrow will be the most beautiful day of his life and his breakfast will taste, you know, better than any meal you or I have ever had. And thinking like, yeah, like to a certain degree, you know, how often do I take for granted like the fact that I have three meals on my table every single day and, you know, that I have great friends and like, you know, we should be more grateful for the things that we have in our life. Poor Raymond that's probably not the case. His breakfast is probably not going to, he's probably going to be traumatized for the rest of his life. But you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that there are seeds here of like something to take away from this movie and apply to your life. I guess that's ultimately what I'm trying to say. Yeah. And I feel like I'm grasping at it a little bit, that there's the beginning of a message here that is helpful and empowering, but it's just where they end up taking it is obviously not something that would be that we would want applied for any of the young men that we have in our society. Yeah. Do you know what I mean by all
this?
No,
yeah, absolutely. And I love that you said that you could take stock of your life and you could say, sure, I've been told through media and all this that things were owed to me and I could be this. Well, I'm not. So instead of being bitter about it, just put your head down and work. Don't expect anything. Why would you expect anything to come your way? Work. Go work. Put your time in. Don't wallow in depression. Don't be that Gen Xer. Don't fall into this trap of thinking you're owed anything. Put your head down and work. Wake up. You know, I guess if you're going to wake up, yes, I have a corporate job. I do not enjoy my corporate job, but it pays the bills. So I'm going to look for something else. You know, you don't have to go get your teeth broken. And so you're right. It gives you very little other options to succeed. And there's so many different ways to succeed. I think this is just like a heightened take on that, if that makes sense. And so,
I'm a huge proponent. I mean, this is getting philosophical, but like, I'm a huge proponent of like, control what you can control. Mm-hmm. There are lots of things in life that are out of our control. People are born into, you know, great circumstances. Some people are born into terrible circumstances. You know, some people have opportunities that others don't. Those things definitely exist. But to spend your time and effort and energy worrying about those things that are out of your control, I just don't think is necessarily helpful or productive. It's the things that you said, it's formulating a game plan. Okay, you don't like your circumstances. What can you change? What do you have control over? And how can you influence those things? And so, again, I think that this movie touches on that. And you have a guy that in this very sort of like twisted, crazy way makes extraordinary changes, right, to his life. And so there's something there that is appealing about that. Same thing with like a Limitless, right? You've got a guy who takes extraordinary measures to get out of, you know, his sort of sad, depressing life. And maybe that's why these types of movies appeal to us. Mm-hmm. But again, I think it's important to acknowledge that this is a parody, that it is, you know, that these characters are caricatures of real life.
When you get to Life Change Avenue and you see the narrator take a right, you take a left.
yeah, exactly.
No, but yeah, I mean, there is some of that in this. And that article we read that I sent you, from The New Yorker, mm-hmm. I believe?
Yeah, great article.
Some people did say that, yes, I went and I bettered my life after watching this, and I didn't punch anybody in the face. I didn't blow up a Starbucks. I didn't burn my hand. I didn't shave my head and call myself a space monkey. just went and did something. So, I mean, I think there is the positive that can come out of this film. But I think one more time. But you know what's interesting, though? The most common complaint about this movie are the people, I think the entitled, the angry, the people who watched it and went, yeah, I'm owed something. And I don't think Fincher should be to blame for that, because there's enough. I didn't have that reaction. I mean, I did buy a Kick Someone's Ass shirt, but you know me, Phil. Like, I rented every UFC tape. I boxed in backyards, cul-de-sacs, front yards, weight rooms, alleys, parking lots. Weight room, gyms, front yards,
just about
backyards.
That life.
Yeah, and
just
bars.
About that life.
Yeah, I just like the box. And so, you know, I don't think I ever. But I don't. You know what's interesting? I never really relished any of those boxing matches. I didn't. I never relished pain. I don't think I ever relished hurting somebody. I'm saying relish a lot. I didn't enjoy that. And also, you know, a lot of times I never went into any of those to hurt. I think I just subconsciously, since I, you know, you grow up in maybe like a rough situation, you like to have those few minutes of just focusing on something else. And it's very extreme. And I could have read a book. There's other things, but you know, I was young and didn't really think about that. So where was I trying to say? Where was I going with this? But yeah, I just think there's much better ways to deal with the angst as opposed to how people do in Fight Club. But for me, I can listen. People watch Joker, and I think they maybe get the wrong idea. But like, you know, with Joker, I think it's really interesting that you have this mentally ill man, and the rest of people use him. They use him to cause chaos. They use him as a figure. They take advantage of him to go cause chaos, if that makes sense. And then, you know, what's interesting too is the narrator is a total leech. I mean, in the beginning, he's going to these groups, which is hits differently, much now differently, going to all these support groups as it does now. But he goes to these groups to leech off of people, to leech off their emotions. And so it only makes sense that he would create a Tyler Durden who sort of leeches off weak and angry men to accomplish his goals, if that makes sense. So in both their worlds, Edward Norton is leeching, the narrator is leeching off of men and women unbeknownst to them. But when he becomes uber narrator, he is the cult leader who leeches off these impressionable men to get his corporate anger and agenda out. And you know what's crazy? Even when he gets that, even when he achieves it, he still destroys Angel Face, Jared Leto. So even though he's never going to be happy. Right. He has to like once he has this, he still wants to destroy somebody's face. Like he wanted to destroy something beautiful. But he's just a leech. He is. And I think the only reason he works with Marla is because she sees him as who he is. And he sees her, if that makes sense. And they're comfortable in that. But I don't know. Between that realization of him being a leech in two different ways, and then just learning about how Fincher's process works. Process? Whatever. How he works was made this all worth it. Made all the research, all the commentaries, all the behind the scenes worth it. So yeah, I mean, I guess, does that make sense about the leech and...
Yeah, 100%. And it does sort of make me think about the end of the end of the movie and whether, you know, the end is sort of not super... definitive in terms of like, okay, so he manages to kill Tyler somehow, which I'll have to get you to explain how that works, because it's something I've always wondered about, that the actual mechanics of him like shooting himself, why that kills Tyler and not him. But ultimately I think he kills Tyler. He maybe recognizes that he no longer needs Tyler, or just manages to get rid of him for whatever reason. But I'm not sure where we go from there. You know, has he learned his lesson? Is he going to now move forward, you know, with a more normal life as a enlightened, self-actualized person? I'm not too sure. I'm not too sure that he's quite figured all of that out by the end.
No, yeah. First thing first is getting that bullet hole taken care of. I do think... Yeah. I mean, listen, I think the ending of the Pixies and the buildings blowing up is beautiful, that I've never thought about him after the movie. I just think about the Pixies song. And so, you know the book, you know the book, right? Where he meets Tyler on a nude beach, and then he goes crazy, and then he shoots himself, goes to an institution, but then the people working there are part of Fight Club. So
Right.
But in this one, you know what's interesting? He either has schizophrenia or DID. But you can't get rid of that by shooting yourself in the face. Like, that's not how things work. So
right.
I think in certain points, it's, I don't know if that really, you can't, I mean, you need medicine. You need, you need something to level out your schizophrenia. You need professional help, counseling, not a bullet. I think, you know, that's a great point because, okay, he wants to get rid of Tyler because, you know, he realizes that it's gone too far. So he created a super ego, but that ego went too far, even though it's him. So then he stops him. But yeah, what is he still in charge of Project Mayhem? His project, I mean, all the credit card companies are destroyed. There's going to be chaos for a while. Mm-hmm. So if you're like a nihilist, if you are an anarchist and you create the ultimate anarchy, what do you do then? When the world is falling apart and you're all about nihilism, what's further? I mean, you're not going to take advantage of the people that are being hurt. So maybe he does retire. Maybe just, you know, maybe he and the space monkeys go to Palm Springs and get some condos. And I don't know.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact line, but at one point in the film, Tyler says something about, you know, the world that I envision is where we're out hunting game, sort of like in the abandoned city streets, essentially, right? And so it really does sort of paint this like post-apocalyptic, society is completely disrupted, you know, type of world that we're now living in. And so certainly, blowing up those buildings and destroying the credit card companies is a step towards that, right?
He's like Thanos, and he wants to live in the I Am Legend world, pretty much.
Everything imploding.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's really interesting. What does he learn at the end? You know, that's really a cool visual and a great song. Just have never made, you know, I gotta tell you something. I have never thought what's next in Fight Club.
Yeah.
Never. Not once. Because I just love that Pixie song. That's a really interesting point. Because, you know, what's interesting, when that song comes on, I'm like, all right, it's over. I always shut off after that. So.
Yeah. I think it speaks to, again, the experience, you know, just to circle back again. Like, I think now the experience of watching this movie, you enjoy it for the acting performances. You enjoy it, like you're saying, for the style, for the cinematography, for the crazy, you know, things that they're doing with the filming techniques to make this film look the way that it looks. And yeah, there's some philosophy, there's some ideas to think about. But it really isn't a story that you're necessarily going to pull a whole lot out of and carry with you and be thinking about. Whereas, again, I just feel like as a young person seeing this for the first time, it was like it was life altering in a lot of ways. It was such an impactful film just in terms of getting me to think about, so if it's not about buying, you know, having a great job and buying a house and buying a great pair of khakis, you know, you're not your khakis. Well, then what is my purpose? And these are questions that you're naturally asking yourself as a young person anyway. And so this film really just emphasizes that much more and like kind of plays a role in getting you to think about those things. But I think largely then once you become a, you know, guy in your 30s with a job and a family and everything else, like, you know, I know for myself, I feel much more sort of like, I know what my purpose is now. And so it's really more just, it's more about the entertainment. It's more about the parody. It's more about the fun and kind of the craziness that this movie is. And it's just enjoying it for what it is. Do you agree with that? Like, is that kind of how you feel about it now?
Because none of these characters dig deep. None of these characters, they all look for the easy way out. I think they all, they don't try to better their lives. They just want to wreck everyone else's. Because of their anger. So I think they've given up on actual three-dimensional, or like, what's the word? They've given up on thought. I think they just want to cause chaos now and blame somebody else to prevent them from looking at themselves. So I think you get some good thoughts out of this movie, but also I gotta say though, I think Dr. Strangelove hits a lot harder as satire than this one does. And I know I'm comparing Kubrick to Fincher, but watching Strangelove and how the world ends and the absolute stupidity and lunacy that leads up to it is so much more effective in my book, because Peter Sellers turning it on as Dr. Strangelove, playing three characters, I think the farceness of it I think it makes it hit so much harder. So I wonder if more discussions would be had if this movie was a bit more Looney Tunes.
Hmm.
But since it's so style, I think this movie is a exercise in stylishness, I think. Whereas I don't know if there's too much substance in it. Call me crazy, because it doesn't tackle mental health. It doesn't tackle.
No.
And it's not so. It's pretty bleak, right?
It's pretty bleak and nihilistic.
I've never thought much about the themes of this movie. I never have. I like the looks of it. I thought it was cool. Hey, let's go box. And they're like, well, I got to go to work. I'm cool. I'll see y'all later. You know, it's, I don't know, but I think I can see how people who are angry could use this as a rallying cry, but I think level-headed people watch it and just enjoy the exercise.
Yeah, I agree. I would hope so. But it is amazing, right? How when you start to dig into the research, you see the impact, you know, that the movie has had. It was one of my favorite notes reading about or doing some research about this in advance as well, was that they had no idea how to market this movie.
None.
After it was made.
Oh, man.
They're like, I was just reading one of the things off of IMDb. It says, like, after David Fincher finished editing the film, the studio executives were baffled by the piece and unsure how to market it. And basically, they made it look like it was a fight movie.
Yep.
They played it during UFC and wrestling events. And it's interesting because for all that it's called Fight Club, it's a movie, you know, largely about fighting. The fighting actually, like, there's not a ton of fighting in it. It doesn't play a huge role in the movie. But certainly it did well at the box office that first weekend, I think, because people thought they were going to go see a fight movie. And obviously it was something completely different.
And you know what's interesting, what I like about Finch? So I read a book, Brian Raftery. I'm name dropping, but he was on Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, and he wrote about me in 2017 for Wired. I always mention that, but he's awesome. He wrote a book called Best Year Ever about 1999, and he covered Fight Club. Mm. And he said, and in it, Fincher admits to making a movie that's impossible to market. And
so funny.
And he said a lot of Fox executives just put their hands up in the air. And the guy who greenlit it lost his job at the head of Fox.
Yeah.
Yeah. They blew up the Fox buildings in this. So sometimes I feel for marketers, like the movie Crimson Peak that Guillermo del Toro directed. If I'm a marketer and I get handed that movie, it's like, this movie's $70 million and it's like a gothic romance. I'm going to make it a ghost story in the trailers. Like, you don't, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Right. And so I think this movie, I think that they did the best they could. I think where they came into it was with the DVD. That's when they finally figured it out. Right. That's when they put it all together. And then, I don't know, that's where it flourished with the menus.
Because it actually, like, I think in the end didn't end up doing particularly well at the box office, mm-hmm. but where it really found its life was on DVD. Absolutely.
Just, it was everywhere. And I mean, I went and bought it during school, but I skipped school a lot. Like, not a lot, but I would, you know, go to lunch when you weren't supposed to. I would, you know, I went to go see Snatch. So it's not like I wasn't skipping mm-hmm. school all the time. Like, I went to school. Like, if I had tennis season coming around, I wasn't missing school. But yeah, I mean, I was like, that was an event for me going and getting Fight Club on that movie. But yeah, I guess I just always thought it was cool. But this, you know, I gotta tell you, I've never thought deeply about this movie. It's really interesting. And oh, here, before we get out of here, before I forget. I asked the movie, so 99 is like one of my favorite years ever for movies because I was working in a theater. Mm-hmm. I think it's Loaded and Deep Blue Sea came out in 99. But I asked a bunch of movies, films, and flicks followers to mention their favorite 1999 movies. And do you mind if I read a few real quick?
Yeah, please.
Right. So I asked them to give me their top three. All right. And I got, let's see. So Andy wrote, he said Straight Story, Ghost Dog, which is awesome, and Willow and Wind. Jesse Deals said Galaxy Quest, The Matrix, and South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, which I have a really hard time liking because I had to clean the theaters for that movie, and it was always dirty. Just gross people went in there. So Niall Moore said Galaxy Quest, Matrix, and Office Space. Neil Mitchell's hilarious. He did Office Space, Ravenous, EdTV, then he had about 14 honorable mentions, which I totally get. Joe Ullen said The Mummy, The Matrix, and American Pie. Randy B said Audition, Princess Mononoke, and Office Space. John Wheeler, Johnny Numb. He wrote Fight Club, Election, and The Blair Witch Project. And he could say back in 99, he would have put American Beauty. Billy Boyko, who I played tennis with at Hudson High School, he said The Matrix, The Boondock Saints, and The Phantom Menace. Alex Kolick said Galaxy Quest, Sixth Sense, and The Mummy. Lisa Skippin said Never Been Kissed, Lake Placid, and 10 Things I Hate About You. And Mark P, Fight Club, American Beauty, and The Matrix.
You just to jump in quickly, the Never Been Kissed thing, did you on the Blu-ray of Fight Club, when the menu pops up, it actually starts as Never Been Kissed. Like the it's like an in joke that they had where the menu for Never Been Kissed comes up and you're like, what is going on here? I've got the wrong movie. And then the menu for Fight Club, like whatever, crashes through and pops up, which is unbelievable.
Oh, that's amazing. I just had I have the DVD, so I didn't have that. I just had the menu pop up. So I never
I can remember I can't even remember because I own it on DVD as well and not Blu-ray, but I have seen that at some point. Someone else, somebody that I know must have it on Blu-ray.
And hey, can we those are, some, oh sorry, go for it.
Yeah. I was gonna say those are all solid lists. As you were reading those off, I couldn't believe like I totally forgot that The Matrix came out in 99 and right. Phantom Menace was 99.
Huge year. Blair Witch. Hey, so how about this? To promote this podcast, let's do a 1999 draft. So we don't have to do it to win it. We'll just pick five 1999. Like you pick one, I pick one, and we'll so if it's off the board, you can't take it. So I'll let you pick first.
Okay, sounds good.
And we'll just pick five movies that we love from 1999. So I'll let you have the first pick.
Okay, I Googled 1999 movies. I've got my list here in front of me. I guess that's my first pick. I will go with Office Space, which also, again, is a movie that speaks to and so much more of a parody, right? Like we're saying, like much more of an explicit, obvious parody of the American working world. And so similar themes. The 1999 was a big year for the frustrated office worker between Fight Club and Office Space. So, yeah, I'll go with that.
And he starts stealing a bunch of stuff. But I think Milton's just I have a red stapler in my office right now, and just the tchotchkes and the flair. Oh my gosh. All right, I'm taking Deep Blue Sea. I have to. I have a podcast. I have a podcast about it. So it's the number one crowd participation movie I've ever seen in my life. So I'm taking Deep Blue Sea. What are you doing second?
I'm gonna pick. Second, I will take Star Wars: The Phantom Menace as well. I'm a bit of a Phantom Menace defender. I really think that. Yes, there's the Jar Jar Binks, you know, of it all, and it is, you know, it's got its flaws, but that fight scene with Darth Maul alone for me makes it worth watching, and I'm okay with some pod racing actually. Like I don't think that the pod upon the rewatch, the pod racing was not nearly as bad as everybody made it out to be. But that fight scene is one of the most phenomenal fight scenes I've ever seen in my entire life. So Phantom Menace all day.
You know what I love about the interesting thing about Star Wars is I love all of them. I have the VHS tapes from 1990. I've seen them all. Mm-hmm. I just adore the Star Wars movies, but I've never gotten emotional over them. Like I went and watched Phantom Menace. I'm like, that was good. I liked it. Mm-hmm. I watched Attack of the Clones. I'm like, that was cool. That battle scene was neat. I watched Last Jedi that everyone hated. I'm like, that was cool. I liked it. Ryan Johnson was not taking any JJ's crap. I love it. None of those shows, even the Boba Fett show that people hated. Like I've just seen so much. I know whatever this word, but I've seen so much toxic Star Wars fandom that I've gone the other way. And I'm like, it's Star Wars. It's cool. It's a pod race. Yeah. It's fun. But also George Lucas takes so many chances in those movies with technology that I have to admire it. I love The Phantom Menace. I don't care. I saw it 3 times in the theaters. It's awesome. Get over yourself. All right. I'm going to take The Mummy.
Yeah.
That's
also phenomenal.
Just the like Rachel Weisz, Brendan Fraser, Benny. I mean, Benny's one of the greatest all-time kind of side characters. Even the brother's hilarious. And Oded Fehr's in it. He's so cool. And just Arnold Vosloo. There's such a deep bench in that movie. And that sandstorm scene. Oh, man. Chef's kiss.
Oh, just incredible. Yeah, incredible. Yeah, I got to go back and rewatch The Mummy again soon. I love that movie.
It's one of the most popular episodes ever for movies, films, and flicks, The Mummy. People adore that movie.
go back and watch the movie and re-listen to the episode.
Yeah.
For pick number three, only because, again, my wife and I rewatched this movie lately, some nostalgia here, fun high school movie. Give me She's All That, right?
Right about now. Funk's old Packy brother. Check that out now. Right? Isn't that the song where everyone started dancing? Mm-hmm, oh, mm-hmm. Man.
Paul Walker is like the jerk friend in that movie.
Oh, man.
Which I totally forgot.
And then like Kiss Me and all those songs. And oh, yeah.
Yeah, great soundtrack. Yeah.
What a cast. That was good. I love that movie. Yeah, heck yeah. Right, I'm going to do Bowfinger because I think...
Bowfinger. I've seen that.
I think it's one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. And I think Eddie Murphy's dual performances are... Like, you know, critics like it. It made money. It's also one of the more listened to episodes ever. I've done a lot of 99 movies, but it's just such a nice, funny movie. But I think Eddie Murphy's and Steve Martin's performances are slept on. Also, Jamie Kennedy. I think it's popular and it made money, but I still think it's not appreciated as much as it should be. So I'm going with Bowfinger. Mm-hmm.
Man, 99. What a phenomenal year for movies. I will go with my next... I'll go another comedy. I'll go Big Daddy. This is like Adam Sandler, yeah. You know, at the peak of his powers. I love Big Daddy.
Hip-hop-opotamus? Isn't that...
It says here his teeth are made of wool. Sometimes I mix up D and L. Like, I love that movie.
You know what I love about that movie? I don't have the box office numbers on me now, but it made like $300 million. There's no action in it. It's not R-rated. It's not like an American Pie bowed, you know, like raunchy jokes. It's just Adam Sandler getting a kid in a bank.
Just denting cans in the grocery store.
Like, so Big Daddy box office. How much do you want to guess it made worldwide?
So you said 300.
I was too high there. I was high.
Too high?
Yeah.
I'll go 225 million.
234.
Wow.
But that's nuts for Big Daddy. And I'm not insulting Big Daddy. It's just I love it. And yeah, those Adam Sandler at his power. The height.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, I'm gonna take the 13th Warrior.
Nice.
I mean, listen, I love that movie so much. Adam and I covered it. Adam Hodgins and I covered it. It's just a $100 million, beautiful to look at, excellent action scenes. Beowulf, I think his name is. Beowulf at the end when he sits down and makes that speech. And, oh, dude, 13th Warrior. That's it. 13th Warrior. I'm picking that.
It's a solid pick.
All right. So what's your fifth?
Okay, my fifth, my last one. Again, I can't believe the comedies that came out this year, so I'm gonna stick with that, I guess. Give me the Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, which I'm pretty sure I saw in theaters twice. Again, Mike Myers and Austin Powers at like the height of his powers, man. Literally. Yeah, I don't know. I loved those movies back in the day.
I wonder how much money that movie made.
Probably, yeah.
I think that's a 300 millioner. I don't know. Let me check. Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged. Oops. Shag Me. Box office. Oh, 312.
Wow.
Remember when names used to be a thing? Like, I'm going to go see a Sandler picture. We don't really have that too much anymore.
No.
All right. So people are probably going to be angry that I didn't pick Galaxy Quest, but I don't care. Mystery Men, Idle Hands. Oh,
outside, I saw Mystery Men in theaters as well. Oh, yeah.
Outside Providence, there's a great line in that. But I'm gonna take one that not many people have watched, and that's Ravenous. One of the crazy.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
It's like a Wendigo movie with Guy Pearce and Robert Carlyle, but it has the craziest score. Yeah, Antonio Bird directed it. It's just a bonkers, beautiful movie. So I'm gonna take Ravenous. And you can listen. I recorded that episode with David Cross on this podcast, so you can listen to that as well. Actually, I've done episodes about all the movies I picked. Interesting.
99 was a good year.
But hey, well, thank you so much for joining me, Phil. This was great. And you know, I've never talked this in depth about Fight Club ever. I've lived with it for so long and owned it and had a shirt, but I've never explored it before. And this was a lot of fun.
Yeah, man, I this movie again was super impactful on me as a young guy. So thanks so much for diving in. I really enjoyed this.
And then you sent me a big list of movies, so I'll go through that on when you sent me, and then we'll pick from that next. But looking forward to having you on again.
Yeah, man, a lot of Christopher Nolan. I'm gonna become the MMF, Christopher Nolan correspondent here. So looking forward to it.
I'm talking to Phil Briggs outside of Gotham Central. Yeah. All right, cool. Well, hey, thank you so much for joining me.
Anytime.
All right, so for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, Phil Briggs, this is Movie Social Flicks. We'll see you next week.